Do you understand how all of those work?
Yes, King Onhegg. You see, counterweight off balances the...
Don't explain it to me, please. As long as somebody I know and trust understands, that's all that's really important.
Later that same day, the first Kerak ship was lifted to the top of the escarpment. King Onhegg watched the procedure for a moment or two, then winced and turned his back.
It's unnatural, he muttered to Barak.
You've taken to using that expression a great deal lately, Barak noted.
Onhegg scowled at his cousin.
I just mentioned it, that's all, Barak said innocently.
I don't like changes, Barak. They make me nervous.
The world moves on, Onhegg. Things change every day.
That doesn't necessarily mean that I have to like it, the King of Kerak growled. I think I'll go to my tent for a drink or two.
You want some company?
I thought you wanted to stand around and watch the world change.
It can do that without my supervision.
And probably will, Onhegg nodded moodily. All right, let's go. I don't want to watch this anymore.
And the two of them went off in search of something to drink. Chapter 11 Maya Serena, Queen of Arindia, was in a pensive mood. She sat at her embroidery in the large, sunny nursery high in the palace at Vomimbre. Her infant son, the Crown Prince of Arindia, cooed and gurgled in his cradle as he played with the string of brightly colored beads that had been the ostensible gift of the Crown Prince of Thrasnia. Maya Serena had never met Queen Porin, but the shared experience of motherhood made her feel very close to the reputedly exquisite little blonde on her far northern throne. Seated in a chair not far from the queen sat Nerina, Baroness of Voebor. Each lady wore velvet, the queen in deep purple, and the baroness in pale blue, and each wore the high conical white headdress so admired by the Mimbrate nobility. At the far end of the nursery, an elderly lutenist softly played a mournful air in a minor key. The Baroness Nerina appeared to be even more melancholy than her queen. The circles beneath her eyes had grown deeper and deeper in the weeks since the departure of the Mimbrate knights, and she seldom smiled. Finally, she sighed and laid aside her embroidery.
Ah, the sadness of thy heart! Doth resound in thy sighing, Nerina,
the queen said gently.
Think not so of dangers and separation, lest thy spirits fail thee utterly. Oh, instruct me in the art of banishing care, then, your highness,
Nerina replied,
for I am in sore need of such teaching. My heart is bowed beneath a burden of concern, and try though I might to control them, my thoughts, like unruly children, return ever to the dreadful peril of my absent lord and our dearest friend. Be comforted in the knowledge that thy burden is shared by every lady in all of Mimbre, Nerina.
Nerina sighed again.
Ah, my care, however, lies in more mournful certainty. Other ladies, their affections firm fixed on one beloved, can dare to hope that he might return from dreadful war unscathed. But I, who love too, can find no reason for such optimism. I must needs lose one at the least, and the prospect doth crush my soul.
There was quiet dignity in Nerina's open acceptance of the implications of the two loves that had become so entwined in her heart that they could no longer be separated. Maya Serena, in one of those brief flashes of insight which so sharply illuminated understanding, perceived that Nerina's divided heart lay at the very core of the tragedy that had lifted her, her husband, and Sir Mandolalan into the realms of sad legend. If Nerina could but love one more than the other, the tragedy would end. But so perfectly balanced was her love for her husband with her love for Sir Mandolalan that she had reached a point of absolute stasis. Forever frozen, between the two of them. The queen sighed. Narina's divided heart seemed somehow a symbol of divided Orindia. But though the gentle heart of the suffering baroness might never be made one, Maya Serena was resolved to make a last effort to heal the breach between Mimbre and Asturia. To that end, she had summoned to the palace a deputation of the more stable leaders of the rebellious north, and her summons had appeared over a title she rarely used, Duchess of Asturia. At her instruction, the Asturians were even now drawing up a list of their grievances for her consideration. Later, on that same sunny afternoon, Maya Serena sat alone on the double throne of Orindia, painfully aware of the vacancy beside her. The leader and spokesman of the group of Asturian noblemen was Count Reldigan, a tall, thin man with iron-gray hair and beard, who walked with the aid of a stout cane. Reldigan wore a rich green doublet and black hose, and, like the rest of the deputation, his sword was belted at his side. The fact that the Asturians came armed into the queen's presence had stirred some angry muttering, but Maya Serena had refused to listen to urgings that their weapons be taken from them.
"My lord Reldigan,"
the queen greeted the Asturian as he limped toward the throne.
"Your grace," he replied with a bow.
"Your majesty,"
a Mimbrate courtier corrected him in a shocked voice.
"Her grace summoned us as the Duchess of Asturia,"
Reldigan informed the courtier coolly.
"The title commands more respect from us than other, more recent embellishments."
"Gentlemen, please,"
the queen said firmly.
"Prithee, let us not commence hostilities anew. Our purpose here is to examine the possibilities of peace. I entreat thee, my lord Reldigan, speak to the purpose. Unburden thyself of the causes of that rancor which hath so hardened the heart of Asturia. Speak freely, my lord, and with no fear of reprisal for thy words."
She looked quite sternly at her advisers.
"It is our command that no man be taken to task for what is spoken here."
The Mimbrates glowered at the Asturians, and the Asturians scowled back.
"Your grace," Reldigan began, "our chief complaint lies, I think, in the simple fact that our Mimbrate overlords refuse to recognize our titles. A title is an empty thing, really. But it implies a responsibility which has been denied to us. Most of us here are indifferent to the privileges of rank, but we keenly feel the frustration of being refused the chance to discharge our obligations. Our most talented men are compelled to waste their lives in idleness, and might I point out, Your Grace, that the loss of that talent injures Orindia even more than it injures us."
"That is well spoken, my lord,"
the queen murmured.
"Might I respond,
Your Majesty?"
the aged white-bearded Baron of Voceren inquired.
"Certainly, my lord,"
Maya Serena replied.
"Let us all be free and open with one another."
"The titles of the Asturian gentlemen are theirs for the asking,"
the Baron declared.
"For 5 centuries, the crown has awaited but the required oath of fealty to bestow them. No title may be granted or recognized until its owner swears allegiance to the crown."
"Unfortunately, my lord,"
Reldigan said,
"we are unable to so swear. The oaths of our ancestors to the Duke of Asturia are still in force, and we are still bound by them."
"The Asturian Duke of whom you speak died 500 years ago,
the old Baron reminded him.
"But his line did not die with him,"
Reldigan pointed out.
"Her Grace is his direct descendant, and our pledges of loyalty are still in force."
The queen stared first at one, then at the other.
I pray thee, she said, correct me if my perception is awry. Is the import of what has been revealed here that Orindia hath been divided for half a millennium by an ancient formality?
Reldigan pursed his lips thoughtfully.
There is a bit more to it than that, Your Grace, but that does seem to be the core of the problem.
500 years of strife and bloodshed over a technicality?
Count Reldigan struggled with it. He started to speak several times, but broke off each time with a look of helpless perplexity. In the end, he began to laugh.
That is sort of Orindish, isn't it?
He asked rather whimsically. The old Baron of Voceren gave him a quick look, and then too began to chuckle.
I pray thee, my Lord Reldigan, lock this discovery in thy heart, lest we all become the subject of general mirth. Let us not confirm the suspicion that abject stupidity is our most prevailing trait.
Why was this absurdity not discovered previously?
Massarina demanded. Count Reldigan shrugged sadly.
I suppose because Asturians and Mimbres do not talk to each other, Your Grace. We were always too eager to get to the fighting.
Very well, the Queen said crisply. What is required to rectify this sorry confusion?
Count Reldigan looked at the Baron.
A proclamation, perhaps?
He suggested. The old man nodded thoughtfully.
Her Majesty could release thee from thy previous oath. It hath not been common practice, but there are precedents.
And then we all swear fealty to her as Queen of Orindia?
That would seem to satisfy all the demands of honor and propriety, yes.
But I am the same person, am I not?
The Queen objected.
Technically, thou art not, Your Majesty, the Baron explained. The Duchess of Asturia and the Queen of Orindia are separate entities. Thou art indeed two persons in one body.
This is most confusing, gentlemen,
Maya Serena observed.
That's probably why no one noticed it before, Your Grace,
Reldigan told her.
Both you and your husband have two titles, and two separate formal identities.
He smiled briefly.
I'm surprised that there was room on the throne for such a crowd.
Then his face grew serious.
It will not be a cure-all, Your Grace. The divisions between Mimbre and Asturia are so deep-seated that they will take generations to erase.
And wilt thou also swear fealty to my husband?
The Queen asked.
As the King of Orindia, yes. As the Duke of Mimbre, never.
That will do for a start, my lord. Let us see then to this proclamation. Let us with ink and parchment bandage our poor Orindia's most gaping wound.
That was beautifully put, Your Grace,
Reldigan said admiringly. Ranburun the 23rd had spent almost his entire life inside the imperial compound at Tolhanath. His infrequent trips to the major cities of Tolnedra had, for the most part, been made inside closed carriages. It was entirely probable that Ranburun had never walked a continuous mile in his life, and a man who has not walked a mile has no real conception of what a mile is. From the very outset, his advisers despaired of ever making him understand the concept of distance. The suggestion that ultimately resolved the difficulty came from a rather surprising source. A sometime tutor named Jeebers, a man who had narrowly escaped imprisonment or worse the previous summer, put forth the suggestion diffidently. Master Jeebers now did everything diffidently. His near brush with imperial displeasure had forever extinguished the pompous self-importance that had previously marred his character. A number of his acquaintances were surprised to discover that they even liked the balding, skinny man now. Master Jeebers had pointed out that if the Emperor could only see things in exact scale, he might then understand. Like so many good ideas that had surfaced from time to time in Tol Nedra, this one immediately got out of hand. An entire acre of the imperial grounds was converted into a scale replica of the border region of eastern Algaria and the opposing stretches of Mishrak Akhtul. To give it all perspective, a number of inch-high human figures were cast in lead to aid the emperor in conceptualizing the field of operations. The emperor immediately announced that he'd really like to have more of the lead figures to aid his understanding of the masses of men involved. And a new industry was born in Tol Honoth. Overnight, lead became astonishingly scarce. In order that he might better see the field, the emperor mounted each morning to the top of a 30-foot-high tower that had been hastily erected for the purpose. There, with the aid of a great-voiced sergeant of the Imperial Guard, the emperor deployed his leaden regiments of infantry and cavalry in precise accordance with the latest dispatches from Algeria. The general staff very nearly resigned their commissions en masse. They were, for the most part, men of advanced middle age, and joining the emperor atop his tower each morning involved some strenuous climbing. They all tried at various times to explain to the beak-nosed little man that they could see just as well from the ground, but Ranbarun would have none of it.
"Morin, he's killing us," one portly general complained bitterly to the emperor's chamberlain. "I'd rather go off to war than climb the ladder 4 times a day."
"Of the Drasnian pike, men, 4 paces to the left!"
A sergeant bellowed from the top of the tower, and a dozen men on the ground began redeploying the tiny lead figures.
"We all must serve in the capacity that our emperor chooses for us,"
Lord Morin replied philosophically.
"I don't see you climbing that ladder,"
the general accused.
"Our emperor has chosen another capacity for me,"
Morin said rather smugly. That evening, the weary little emperor sought his bed.
"It is very exciting, Morin,"
he murmured, drowsily holding the velvet-lined case that contained the solid gold figures representing Tzenedra and Rodar and the rest of the army's leaders close to his chest.
"But it is very tiring, too."
"Yes, Your Majesty.
There always seems to be so much that
I still have to do,"
he yawned.
"That is the nature of your command, Your Majesty,"
Morin observed. But the Emperor had already dropped off. Lord Morin removed the case from the Emperor's hands and carefully pulled the covers up around the sleeping man's shoulders.
"Sleep, Ranbarun,"
he said very gently.
"You can play with your little toy soldiers again tomorrow."
Saddi, the eunuch, had quietly left the palace at Stithi's Tor by a secret doorway that opened behind the slaves' quarters onto a shabby back street that twisted and turned in the general direction of the harbor. He had, quite deliberately, waited for the cover of the afternoon rainstorm and had dressed himself in the shabby clothing of a dock worker. Accompanying him was the one-eyed assassin, Asus, who also wore nondescript clothing. Saadi's security precautions were routine, but his choice of Isis as his companion was not. Isis was not a member of the palace guard nor of Saadi's personal retinue, but Saadi was not concerned on this afternoon's outing with appearances or proprieties. Isis was, by and large, uncorrupted by palace politics and had a reputation for unswerving loyalty to whomever was paying him at the moment. The two passed down the rain-swept street to a certain disreputable establishment frequented by lower-class workers and went through a rather noisy tap room to the maze of cubicles at the back, where other entertainments were provided. At the end of a foul-smelling hallway, a lean, hard-eyed woman whose arms were covered from wrist to elbow with cheap, gaudy bracelets pointed wordlessly at a scarred door, then turned abruptly and disappeared through another doorway. Behind the door lay a filthy room with only a bed for furniture. On the bed were two sets of clothing that smelled of tar and salt water, and sitting on the floor were two large tankards of lukewarm ale. Wordlessly, Thadi and Isis changed clothes. From beneath the soiled pillow, Isis pulled a pair of wigs and sets of false whiskers.
"How can they drink this?"
Thadi demanded, sniffing at one of the tankards and wrinkling his nose. Isis shrugged.
"It learns its peculiar tastes. You don't have to drink it at all," Thadi. "Splash most of it on your clothes. Thresnian sailors spill a lot of ale when they're out in search of amusement. How do I look?"
Thadi gave him a quick glance.
"Ridiculous," he replied. "And a beard. Don't really suit you, Isis."
Isis laughed.
"And they look particularly out of place on you."
He shrugged and carefully poured ale down the front of his tar-spattered tunic.
"I suppose we look enough like Drasnians to get by. And we certainly smell like Drasnians. Hook your beard on a little tighter and let's get moving before it stops raining." "Are we going out the back?"
Isis shook his head.
"If somebody's following us, he will watch the back. We will leave the way ordinary Drasnian sailors leave." "And how is that?" "We've made arrangements to have us thrown out."
Thadi had never been thrown out of any place before, and he found the experience not particularly amusing. The two burly ruffians who unceremoniously pitched him into the street were a bit rough about it, and Thadi picked up several scrapes and abrasions in the process. Isis staggered to his feet and stood bawling curses at the closed door, then lurched over and pulled Thadi up out of the mud. Together they reeled in apparent drunkenness down the street toward the Drasnian enclave. Thadi noted that there had been two men in a doorway across the street when he and Isis had been ejected, and that the two did not move to follow. Once they entered the Drasnian enclave, Isis led the way rather quickly to the house of Drublak, the Drasnian port authority. They were admitted immediately and conveyed at once to a dimly lighted but comfortable room where the enormously fat Drublak sat sweating. With him was Count Melgan, the aristocratic ambassador from Tonedra.
"Novel attire for the chief eunuch of some Misra's household," Count Melgan observed as Thadi pulled off his wig and false beard.
"Just a bit of deception, my lord ambassador," Thadi replied. "I didn't particularly want this meeting to become general knowledge."
"Can he be trusted?"
Drublak asked bluntly, pointing at Isis. Thadi's expression became whimsical.
"Can you be trusted, Isis?" he asked. "You have paid me for up to the end of the month," Isis shrugged. "After that, we'll see. I might get a better offer."
"You see," Thadi said to the two seated men, "Isis can be trusted until the end of the month, at least as much as anybody in Stithi's store can be trusted. One thing I've noticed about Isis, he's a simple, uncomplicated man. Once you buy him, he stays bought. I think it's referred to as professional ethics."
Drublak grunted sourly.
"Do you suppose that we could get to the point? Why did you go to so much trouble to arrange this meeting? Why didn't you just summon us to the palace?"
"My dear Drublak," Thadi murmured, "you know the kind of intrigue that infests the palace. I'd prefer that what passes between us remain more or less confidential. The matter itself is rather uncomplicated. I have been approached by the emissary of Tarugos."
The two regarded him with no show of surprise.
"I gather that you two already knew?"
We're hardly children, Sadi, Count Melgon told him.
I am at present in negotiations with the new ambassador from Rakgoska, Sadi mentioned.
Isn't that the third one so far this summer? Melgon asked. Sadi nodded.
The Mergos seem to be particularly susceptible to certain fevers, which abound in the swamps.
We've noticed that, Droblek said dryly. What is your prognosis for the present emissary's continued good health?
I don't imagine he's any more immune than his countrymen. He's already beginning to feel... unwell.
Maybe he will be lucky and recover, Droblek suggested.
Not very likely, Isis said with an ugly laugh. The tendency of Mergo ambassadors to die unexpectedly has succeeded in keeping the negotiations moving very slowly, Zadi continued. I would like for you gentlemen to inform King Rodar and Ranborun that these delays will probably continue.
Why? Droblek asked.
I want them to understand and appreciate my efforts in their present campaign against the Angarak kingdoms.
Tonedra has no involvement in that campaign, Melgon asserted quickly.
Of course not, Zadi smiled.
Just how far are you willing to go, Zadi? Droblek asked curiously.
That depends almost entirely upon who's winning at any given moment, Zadi replied. If the Raven Queen's campaign in the east begins to run into difficulties, I suspect that the pestilence will subside and the Mergo emissaries will stop dying so conveniently. I'd almost have to make an accommodation with Taurogus at that point.
Don't you find that just a bit contemptible, Zadi? Droblek asked acidly. Zadi shrugged.
We are a contemptible sort of people, Droblek, he admitted. But we survive. That's no mean accomplishment for a weak nation lying between two major powers. Tell Rodar and Ranborun that I'll stall the Mergos for as long as things continue to go in their favor. I want them both to be aware of their obligation to me.
And will you advise them when your position is about to change? Melgon asked.
Of course not, Zadi replied. I'm corrupt, Melgon. I'm not stupid.
You're not much of an ally, Zadi, Droblek told him.
I never pretended to be. I'm looking out for myself. At the moment, my interests and yours happen to coincide. That's all. I do, however, expect to be remembered for my assistance.
You're trying to play it both ways, Zadi, Droblek accused him bluntly.
I know. Zadi smiled. Disgusting, isn't it?
Queen Aelina of Kerrick was in an absolute panic. This time Meryl had gone too far. The advice they had received from Porin had seemed quite sound, had indeed raised the possibility of a brilliant stroke which would disarm Grodeg and the Bear Cult once and for all. The imagined prospect of the helpless rage into which this would plummet the towering ecclesiast was almost a satisfaction in itself. Like so many people, Queen Aelina took such pleasure in an imagined triumph, the real thing became almost too much trouble. The victories of the imagination involved no risks, and a confrontation with an enemy always ended satisfactorily when both sides of the conversation came from one's own daydreams. Left to her own devices, Eileena would probably have been content to let it go at that. Merrill, however, was less easily satisfied. The plan devised by the little queen of Drasnia had been quite sound, but it suffered from one flaw. They did not have enough men to bring it off. Merrill, however, had located an ally with certain resources, and had brought him into the queen's inner circle. A group of men in Kerik had not accompanied Anheg and the fleet to Algeria, largely because they were not the sort of men who made good sailors. At Merrill's stern-faced insistence, the queen of Kerik suddenly developed an overpowering enthusiasm for hunting. It was in the forest, safe from prying ears, that the details of the coup were worked out.
"When you kill a snake, you cut off its head,"
Torvik the huntsman had pointed out, as he, Merrill, and Eileena sat in a forest glade while Torvik's men roved through the woods, harvesting enough game to make it appear that Eileena had spent her day in a frenzy of slaughter.
"You don't accomplish all that much by snipping pieces off its tail, an inch or so at a time," the broad-shouldered huntsman continued. "The bear cult isn't really that concentrated in one place. With a little luck, we can gather up all the important members presently in Valarlon in one sweep. That should irritate our snake enough to make him stick his neck out. Then we'll simply chop off his head."
Torvik's use of such terminology had made the queen wince. She had not been entirely sure that the blunt, grizzled forester had been speaking figuratively. And now it had been done. Torvik and his huntsmen had moved quietly through the dark streets of Valalorn for the entire night, gathering up the sleeping members of the bear cult, marching them in groups to the harbor, and then locking them in the holds of waiting ships. Because of their years of experience, the hunters had been very thorough in rounding up their quarry. By morning, the only members of the bear cult left in the city were the high priest of Belar and the dozen or so under-priests lodged in the temple. Queen Eileena sat, pale and trembling, on the throne of Kerik. She wore her purple gown and her gold crown. In her hand she held a scepter. The scepter had a comforting weight to it, and could possibly be used as a weapon in an emergency. The queen was positive that an emergency was about to descend on her.
"This is all your fault, Merrill," she bitterly accused her blonde friend. "If you had just left things alone, we wouldn't be in this mess." "We'd be in a worse one," Merrill replied coldly. "Pull yourself together, Eileena. It's done now. You can't undo it." "Grote terrifies me," Eileena blurted. "He won't be armed. He won't be able to hurt you." "I am only a woman," Eileena quailed. "He'll roar at me in that awful voice of his, and I'll go to absolute pieces." "Stop being such a coward, Eileena," Merrill snapped. "Your timidity's brought Kerik right to the edge of disaster. Every time Grodek's raised his voice to you, you have given him anything he wanted, just because you are afraid of his harsh talk. Are you a child? Does noise frighten you that much?" "You forget yourself, Merrill," Eileena flared suddenly. "I am queen, after all." "Well then, by all the gods, be the queen. Stop behaving like a silly, frightened serving girl. Sit up straight on your throne, as if you had some iron in your backbone, and pinch your cheeks. Why, you're as pale as a bedsheet." Merrill's face hardened. "Listen to me, Eileena. If you give even one hint that you're starting to weaken, I will have Torvik run his spear into Grodek right here in the throne room." "You wouldn't," Eileena gasped. "You can't kill a priest." "He's a man, just like any other man," Merrill declared. "If you stick a spear in his belly, he will die." "Not even Anheg would do that." "I am not Anheg. But you'll be cursed. I'm not afraid of curses."
Torvik came into the throne room, a broad-bladed boar spear held negligently in one big hand.
"He's coming," he announced laconically.
"Oh, dear,"
Alina quavered.
Stop that,
Meryl snapped. Grodig was livid with rage as he strode into the throne room. His white robe was rumpled as if he had thrown it on hastily, and his white hair and beard were uncombed.
I will speak with the queen alone,
he thundered as he approached across the rush-strewn floor.
That is the queen's decision to make, not yours, my lord high priest,
Meryl advised him in a flinty voice.
Does the wife of the Earl of Trelheim speak for the throne?
Grodig demanded of Aelina. Aelina faltered. Then she saw Torvik standing directly behind the tall priest. The boar spear in his hand was no longer so negligently grasped.
Calm yourself, revered Grodig,
the queen said, quite suddenly convinced that the life of the infuriated priest hinged not only on her words, but even on her tone of voice. At the tiniest quaver, Meryl would give the signal, and Torvik would sink that broad, sharp blade into Grodig's back, with about as much emotion as he showed about swatting a fly.
I want to see you alone, Grodig repeated stubbornly.
No.
No?
He roared incredulously.
You heard me, Grodig, and stop shouting at me. My hearing is quite good.
He gaped at her, then quickly recovered.
Why have all my friends been arrested?
He demanded.
They were not arrested, my lord high priest,
the queen replied.
They have all volunteered to join my husband's fleet.
Ridiculous,
he snorted at her.
I think you'd better choose your words a bit more carefully, Grodig,
Meryl told him.
The queen's patience with your impertinence is wearing thin.
Impertinence? He exclaimed. How dare you speak that way to me?
He drew himself up and fixed a stern eye on the queen.
I insist upon a private audience,
he told her in his thunderous voice. The voice, which had always cowed her before, quite suddenly irritated Aelina. She was trying to save this idiot's life, and he kept shouting at her.
My lord Grodig,
she said with an unaccustomed hint of steel in her voice.
If you bellow at me one more time, I will have you muzzled.
His eyes widened in amazement.
We have nothing to discuss in private, my lord,
the queen continued.
All that remains is for you to receive your instructions, which you will follow to the letter. It is our decree that you will proceed directly to the harbor, where you will board the ship which is waiting to transport you to Algeria. There you will join the forces of Kerik in the campaign against the Angoraks.
I refuse,
Grodig retorted.
Think carefully, my lord Grodig, Meryl purred. The queen has given you a royal command. Refusal could be considered treason.
I am the high priest of Balor,
Grodig ground out between clenched teeth, obviously having great difficulty in modulating his voice.
You wouldn't dare ship me off like some peasant conscript.
I wonder if the High Priest of Balor might like to make a small wager on that,
Torvik said with deceptive mildness. He set the butt of his spear on the floor, took a stone from the pouch at his belt, and began to hone the already razor-sharp blade. The steely sound had an obviously chilling effect on Grodig.
You will go to the harbor now, Grodig,
Aelina told him.
And you will get on that ship. If you do not, you will go to the dungeon, where you will keep the rats company until my husband returns. Those are your choices. Join Anheg, or join the rats. Decide quickly. You are starting to bore me. And quite frankly, I am sick of the sight of you.
Queen Poran of Dresnia was in the nursery, ostensibly feeding her infant son. Out of respect for the queen's person, she was unspied upon while she was nursing. Poran, however, was not alone. Javelin, the bone-thin chief of Dresnian intelligence, was with her. For the sake of appearance, Javelin was dressed in a serving-maid's gown and cap, and he looked surprisingly feminine in the disguise he wore with no apparent trace of self-consciousness.
Are there really that many cultists in the intelligence service?
The queen asked, a little dismayed. Javelin sat with his back politely turned.
I am afraid so, Your Highness. We should have been more alert, but we have other things on our minds.
Porin thought about it for a moment, unconsciously rocking her suckling babe.
Elena's moving already, isn't she?
She asked.
That is the word I received this morning, Javelin replied. Gradig's on his way to the mouth of the Alder River already, and the Queen's men are moving out into the countryside, rounding up every member of the cult as they go.
Will it in any way hamper our operations to jerk that many people out of Bakhtor?
We can manage, Your Highness, Javelin assured her. We might have to speed up the graduation of the current class at the academy and finish their training on the job, but we will manage.
Very well, then, Javelin,
Porin decided.
Ship them all out. Get every cult member out of Bakhtor and separate them. I want them sent to the most miserable duty post that you can devise. I don't want any of them within 50 leagues of any other one. There will be no excuses, no sudden illnesses, no resignations. Give each of them something to do, then make him do it. I want every bear cultist who has crept into the intelligence service out of Bakhtor by nightfall.
It will be my pleasure, Porin, Javelin said. Ah, incidentally, that Nadrak merchant, Yarblek, is back from Yar Nadrak, and he wants to talk to you about the salmon runs again. He seems to have this obsessive interest in fish.
Chapter 12. The raising of the Kerrick fleet to the top of the eastern escarpment took a full 2 weeks, and King Rhodar chafed visibly at the pace of the operation.
You knew this was going to take time, Rhodar,
Tynedra said to him, as he fumed and sweated, pacing back and forth with frequent dark looks at the towering cliff face.
Why are you so upset?
Because the ships are right out in the open, Tynedra, he replied testily. There's no way to hide them or disguise them while they're being raised. Those ships are the key to our whole campaign. And if somebody on the other side starts putting a few things together, we might have to meet all of Angarak instead of just the Tulls.
You worry too much. Kohag and Khorodulon are burning everything in sight up there. Zakath and Dorogas have other things to worry about besides what we are hauling up the cliff.
It must be wonderful to be so unconcerned about things, he said sarcastically.
Be nice, Rhodar.
General Varana, still scrupulously dressed in his Tolnedran mantle, limped toward them with that studiously diffident expression that indicated he was about to make another suggestion.
Varana, King Rhodar burst out irritably, why don't you put on your uniform?
Because I am not officially here, Your Majesty,
the general replied calmly.
Tolnedra is neutral in this affair, you will recall. That is a fiction, and we all know it.
A necessary one, however. The Emperor is still holding diplomatic channels open to Atar Orgas and Zakath. Those discussions would deteriorate if someone saw a Tolnedran general swaggering around in full uniform.
He paused briefly.
Would a small suggestion offend Your Majesty? He asked.
That all depends on the suggestion, Rhodar retorted.
Then he made a face and apologized.
I'm sorry, Varana. This delay is making me bad-tempered. What did you have in mind?
I think you might want to give some thought to moving your command operations up to the top about now. You will want things running smoothly by the time the bulk of your infantry arrives, and it usually takes a couple of days to iron out the wrinkles when you set things up.
King Rhodar stared at a Kerrick ship being hoisted ponderously up the cliff.
I'm not going to ride up on one of those, Varana, he declared flatly.
It is absolutely safe, Your Majesty,
Varana assured him.
I have made the trip myself several times,
Even Lady Polgara went up that way just this morning.
Polgara could fly down if something went wrong. I don't have her advantages. Can you imagine the size of the hole that I would make in the ground if I fell that far?
The alternative is extremely strenuous, Your Majesty. There are several ravines running down from the top. They have been leveled out a bit so that the horses can go up, but they are still very steep.
A little sweating won't hurt me.
Varana shrugged. As Your Majesty wishes.
I will keep you company, Rodar,
Tenedra offered brightly. He gave her a suspicious look.
I don't really trust machines either, she confessed. I'll go change clothes and then we can start.
You want to do it today?
His voice was plaintive.
Why put it off?
I can think of a dozen reasons.
The term very steep turned out to be a gross understatement. Precipitous might have been more accurate. The incline made riding horses out of the question, but ropes had been strung along the steeper stretches to aid in the climb. Tenedra, dressed in one of her short dryad tunics, scampered hand over hand up the ropes with an agility of a squirrel. King Rodar's pace, however, was much slower.
"Please stop groaning, Rodar,"
she told him after they had climbed for an hour or so.
"You sound like a sick cow."
"That's hardly fair, Tenedra,"
he wheezed, stopping to mop his streaming face.
"I never promised to be fair,"
she retorted with an impish grin.
"Come along. We still have a long way to go."
And she flitted up another 50 yards or so.
"Don't you think that you're a little underdressed?"
he puffed disapprovingly, staring up at her.
"Proper ladies don't show off so much leg."
"What's wrong with my legs?"
"They are bare. That's what's wrong with them."
"Oh, don't be such a prig. I'm comfortable. That's all that matters. Are you coming or not?"
Rodar groaned again.
"Isn't it almost time for lunch?"
"We just had lunch."
"Did we? I had forgotten already."
"You always seem to forget your last meal, usually before the crumbs have been brushed away."
"That's the nature of a fat man, Tenedra,"
he sighed.
"The last meal is history. It is the next one that's important."
He stared mournfully up the brutal trail ahead and groaned again.
"This was all your idea,"
she heartlessly reminded him. The sun was low in the west when they reached the top. As King Rodar collapsed, Princess Tenedra looked around curiously. The fortifications which had been erected along the top of the escarpment were extensive and quite imposing. The walls were of earth and stone and were perhaps 30 feet high. Through an open gate, the princess saw a series of other lower walls, each fronted by a ditch bristling with sharpened stakes and thorny brambles. At various points along the main wall rose imposing blockhouses, and within the walls were neat rows of huts for the soldiers. The forts swarmed with men, and their various activities raised an almost perpetual cloud of dust. A party of Algar clansmen, smoke-stained and mounted on spent-looking horses, rode slowly in through the gate, and a few moments later a contingent of gleaming membrane knights, pennons snapping from their lances, and the great hoofs of their chargers clattering on the stony ground, rode out in search of yet another town to destroy. The huge hoist at the edge of the escarpment creaked and groaned under the weight of the Kerak ships being raised from the plain below. Some distance away, within the fortified walls, the growing fleet sat awaiting the final portage to the headwaters of the upper river Mardu, some 50 leagues distant. Polgara, accompanied by Durnik and the towering Barak, approached to greet the princess and the prostrate king of Drasnia.
"How was the climb?"
Barak inquired.
"Ghastly," Rodar wheezed. "Does anybody have anything to eat? I think I have melted off about 10 pounds.
"It doesn't show," Barak told him.
That sort of exertion isn't really good for you, Rodar, Polgara told the gasping monarch. Why were you so stubborn about it?
Because I have an absolute horror of heights, Rodar replied. I had climbed 10 times as far to avoid being hauled up that cliff by those contraptions. The idea of all that empty air under me makes my flesh creep.
Barak grinned.
That's a lot of creeping. Will somebody please give me something to eat?
Rodar asked in an anguished tone of voice.
A bit of cold chicken, Durnik offered solicitously, handing him a well-browned chicken leg.
Where did you ever find the chicken?
Rodar exclaimed, eagerly seizing the leg.
The Tulls brought some with them, Durnik told him.
Tulls?
Tenedra gasped.
What are the Tulls doing here?
Surrendering, Durnik replied. Whole villages of them have been showing up for the past week or so. They walk up to the edge of the ditches along the front of the fortification, sit down and wait to be captured. They're very patient about it. Sometimes it's a day or so before anybody has the time to go out and capture them. But they don't seem to mind.
Why do they want to be captured?
There aren't any Grolems here, Durnik explained. No altars to Turek, no sacrificial knives. The Tulls seem to feel that getting away from that sort of thing is worth the inconvenience of being captured. We take them in, put them to work in the fortifications. They're good workers, if you give them the proper supervision.
Is that entirely safe?
Rodar asked, around a mouthful of chicken.
There might be spies among them.
Durnik nodded.
We know. Most spies are usually Grolems. Tull doesn't have the mental equipment to be a spy, so the Grolems have to do it themselves.
Rodar lowered his chicken leg in astonishment.
You're letting the Grolems inside the fortifications?
He demanded.
It's nothing all that serious,
Durnik told him. The Tulls know who the Grolems are, and we let them deal with the problem.
They usually take them a mile or so along the escarpment and then throw them off. At first they wanted to do it right here, but some of their elders pointed out that it might not be polite to drop Grolems down on top of the men working below. So they take them someplace where they won't bother anybody when they fall. Very considerate people, the Tulls. One could almost get to like them.
You have sunburned your nose, Tenedra, Polgara told the little princess. Didn't you think of wearing a hat?
Hats give me a headache,
Tenedra shrugged.
A little sunburn won't hurt me.
You have an appearance to maintain, dear, Polgara pointed out. You're not going to look very queenly with your nose peeling.
Oh, it is nothing to worry about, Lady Polgara. You can fix it, can't you? You know.
Tenedra made a little gesture with her hand that was meant to look magical. Polgara gave her a long, chilly look. King Anheg of Kerak, accompanied by the broad-shouldered Raven Warder, approached them.
Did you have a nice climb? He asked Rodar pleasantly. Who would you like a punch in the nose?
Rodar asked him. King Anheg laughed coarsely.
My, aren't we grumpy today? I've just had some news from home that ought to brighten your disposition a bit. Dispatches?
Rodar groaned, hauling himself wearily to his feet. Anheg nodded.
They sent them up from down below while you were getting your exercise. You're not going to believe what's been going on back there.
But try me.
You absolutely won't believe it.
Anheg, spit it out.
We're about to get some reinforcements. Elena and Porin have been very busy these last few weeks.
Polgara looked at him sharply.
Do you know something?
Anheg said, holding out a folded dispatch.
I wasn't even aware of the fact that Elena knew how to read and write. Now I get this.
Don't be cryptic, Anheg, Polgara told him. What have the ladies been up to?
I gather that after we left, the bear cult began to make itself a bit obnoxious. Grodag apparently felt that with the men out of the way he could take over. He started throwing his weight around in Vaelorn.
Cult members began to surface in the headquarters of Drasnian Intelligence in Bokhtar. It looks as if they've been making preparations for something for years. Anyway, Porin and Eileena began passing information back and forth, and when they realized how close Grodag was to getting his hands onto the real power in the two kingdoms, they took steps. Porin ordered all of the cult members out of Bokhtar, sent them to the most miserable duty posts she could think of. And Eileena rounded up the bear cult in Val'Alorn, every last one of them, and shipped them out to join the army.
They did what?
Rodar gasped. Isn't it amazing? A slow grin spread across Anheg's coarse face. The beauty of this whole thing is that Eileena could get away with it. Well, I could not. Women aren't supposed to be aware of the subtleties involved in arresting priests and noblemen. The need for evidence against them and so on. So, what would be gross impropriety on my part will be laughed off as ignorance on hers. I'll have to apologize to Grodag, of course, but it will be after the fact. The cult will be here, and they will have no honest reason to go back home.
Rodar's answering grin was every bit as wicked as Anheg's.
How did Grodag take it?
He was absolutely livid. I guess Eileena faced him down personally. She gave him the choice of joining us or going to the dungeon.
You can't put the High Priest of Baelor in a dungeon, Rodar exclaimed. Eileena didn't know that, and Grodag knew that she didn't.
She'd have had him chained to the wall in the deepest hole she could find before anybody had gotten around to telling her that it was illegal. Can't you just see my Eileena delivering that kind of ultimatum to the old windbag?
There was a note of fierce pride in Unhug's voice. King Rodar's face grew very sly.
There's bound to be some rather hot fighting in this campaign sooner or later, he noted.
Anheg nodded.
The bear cult prides itself on its fighting ability, does it not?
Anheg nodded again, grinning.
They'd be perfect for spearheading any attacks, wouldn't they?
Anheg's grin grew positively vicious.
I imagine that their casualties will be heavy, the King of Drasnia suggested. It's in a good cause, after all, Anheg replied piously.
If you two have quite finished gloating, I think it's time I got the princess in out of the sun, Bulgara told the two grinning monarchs. The fortified positions atop the escarpment bustled with activity for the next several days. Even as the last of the Kerek ships were raised up the cliffs, the Elgars and Membrates extended their depredations out into the Tullish countryside.
There aren't any crops standing for 50 leagues in any direction,
Hetar reported back.
We'll have to go out farther to find anything else to burn.
You find many Burgos?
Barak asked the hawk-faced man.
A few, Hetar shrugged. Not enough to make it interesting. But we run across one every now and then.
How is Mandor Allen doing?
I have not seen him for a few days,
Hetar replied.
There's a lot of smoke coming from the direction he went, so I imagine that he is keeping busy.
What's the country like out there? King Anheg asked.
It's not bad, once you get past the uplands. The part of Tulldom along the escarpment here is pretty forbidding.
What do you mean by forbidding? I've got to haul my ships through that country.
Rock, sand, a few thorn bushes and no water,
Hetar replied.
And it is hotter than the back door of a furnace.
Thanks, Anheg replied.
You wanted to know,
Hetar told him.
Excuse me, I need a fresh horse and some more torches.
You're going out again?
Barak asked him.
It is something to do.
Once the last of the ships had been raised, The Drasnian hoists began lifting tons of food and equipment that soon swelled King Fulrak's supply dumps within the forts to overflowing. The Tullish prisoners proved to be an invaluable asset, carrying whatever burden they were told to carry without complaint or hesitation. Their coarse features shone with such simple-minded gratitude and eagerness to please that Tenedra found it impossible to hate them, even though they were, technically, the enemy. Slowly, bit by bit, the princess discovered the facts that made the lives of the Tullish people such an unrelieved horror. There was not a family among them that had not lost several members to the knives of the Grolems. Husbands, wives, children, and parents had all been selected for sacrifice, and the thought uppermost in every Tull's life was to avoid the same fate at any cost. The perpetual terror had erased every hint of human affection from the Tull's makeup. He lived in dreadful isolation, without love, without companionship, without any feeling but constant anxiety and dread. The reputedly insatiable appetite of Tullish women had nothing whatsoever to do with morals or lack of them. It was a simple matter of survival. To escape the knife, a Tullish woman was forced to remain perpetually pregnant. She was not driven by lust, but by fear, and her fear dehumanized her entirely.
"How can they live that way?"
the princess burst out to Lady Polgara as the two of them returned to their makeshift quarters in the stout blockhouse which had been erected inside the walls for the use of the leaders of the army.
"Why don't they rebel and drive the Grolems out?"
"And just who is supposed to lead a rebellion, Tenedra?"
Polgara asked her calmly.
"The Tulls know that there are Grolems who can pick the thoughts from a man's mind as easily as you would pick fruit in an orchard. If a Tull even considered organizing some kind of resistance, he would be the next one dragged to the altar."
"But their lives, they're so horrible,"
Tenedra objected.
"Perhaps we can change that," Polgara said. "In a way, what we are trying to do is not only for the benefit of the West, but for the Angraks as well. If we win, they will be liberated from the Grolems. They might not thank us at first, but in time they might learn to appreciate it."
"Why shouldn't they thank us?"
"Because if we win, dear, it will be because we've killed their god. That's a very hard thing to thank someone for."
"But Torak is a monster."
"He is still their god. The loss of one's god is a very subtle and terrible injury. Ask the Ulgos what it's like to live without one. It has been 5,000 years since Ul became their god, and they still remember what it was like before he accepted them."
"We are going to win, are we not?"
Tenedra asked suddenly, all her fears flooding to the surface.
"I don't know, Tenedra,"
Polgara answered quietly.
"No one does. Not me, not Belden, not my father. Not even Aldur. All we can do is try."
"What will happen if we lose?"
the princess asked in a tiny, frightened voice.
"We will all be enslaved in exactly the same way the Tulls are,"
Polgara replied quietly.
"Torak will become king and god over the entire world. The other gods will be banished forever, and the Grolems will be unleashed upon us all."
"I won't live in that kind of world,"
Tenedra declared.
"None of us would care to."
"Did you ever meet Torak?"
the princess asked suddenly. Polgara nodded.
"Once or twice. The last time was at Volmimbre, just before his duel with Brand."
"What is he really like?"
"He is a god. The force of his mind is overwhelming. When he speaks to you, you must listen to him. And when he commands, you must obey him."
"But not you, certainly."
"I don't think you understand, dear."
Polgara's face was grave, and her glorious eyes were as distant as the moon. Without seeming to think about it, she reached out, picked up Erand, and set him on her lap. The child smiled at her, and as he so often did, he reached out and touched the white lock at her brow. "There is a compulsion in Torak's voice that's almost impossible to resist," she continued. "You know that he is twisted and evil, but when he speaks to you, your will to resist crumbles, and you are suddenly very weak and afraid."
"Monsieur, you are not afraid."
"You still don't understand. Of course I was afraid. We all were. Even my father. Pray that you never meet Torak. He is not some petty grolem like Kamdor, or a scheming old wizard like Tutrik. He is a god. He is hideously maimed, and at some point he was thwarted. Something he needed. Something so profound that no human could even conceive of it, was denied to him, and that refusal or rejection drove him mad. His madness is not like the madness of Taragas, who, in spite of everything, is still human. Torak's madness is the madness of a god, a being who can make his diseased imaginings come to pass. Only the orb can truly withstand him. I could, perhaps, resist him for a time. But if he lays the full force of his will upon me, ultimately, I will have to give him what he wants. And what he wants from me is too dreadful to think about."
"I don't exactly follow you, Lady Polgara."
Geryon's aunt looked gravely at the tiny girl. "Perhaps you don't at that. It has to do with a part of the past that the Tolnedran Historical Society chooses to ignore. Sit down, Zinedra, and I will try to explain it to you." The princess sat on a rude bench in their rough chamber. Polgara's mood was unusual, very quiet, even pensive. She placed her arms about Erend and held him close, nestling her cheek against his blonde curls, as if taking comfort from the contact with this small boy. "There are two prophecies, Zinedra," she explained in her rich voice. "But the time is coming when there will be only one. Everything that is or was or is yet to be will become a part of whichever prophecy prevails. Every man, every woman, every child has two possible destinies. For some, the differences are not all that great. But in my case, they are profound."
"I don't quite understand."
"In the prophecy which we serve, the one that has brought us here, I am Polgara the Sorceress, daughter to Belgarath and guardian to Belgarion."
"And in the other?"
"In the other, I am the bride of Torak."
Zinedra gasped.
"And now you see why I was afraid," Polgara continued. "I have been terrified of Torak since my father first explained this to me, when I was no older than you are now. I'm not so much afraid for myself, but more because I know that if I falter,